Senator Roberts, I certainly, with the type of the bill here you have here, you're going to need a bigger room to get all the people that are in favor of it, I'm sure. I do have a little space problem myself in our room in the mornings, about the same size, and have some equally important matters, too. This Senate Bill 50, and I'm certainly real happy to be one of the sponsors, along with Senator Willen and all of the others that have supported us on this, because I think this session of the legislature, probably more than any recent session of the legislature, has an opportunity to do a great deal for in the areas of consumer protection. I think Senate Bill 50 is the start of a very important part of it. And that is my interest in it. I'm not going to try to win the details. It's far more complicated. I'm not about to say that it has my wholehearted support, Senator. And Senator Wilner is here to go into greater detail than I can as to be part of it. Kenny, Senator.
Any questions of Representative Hansen? Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, at the last session, Representative Hansen and I also sponsored a bill designed to provide statewide enforcement of the Oregon Consumer Fraud Law. Unfortunately, that bill got mixed up in the question of who is to be Attorney General of Oregon, which is a controversy that was undetermined at that point. I think some of you know, though, the bill came out of the way the committee failed. I want to give the committee a very brief history, summarize the intentions of the bill and why it's important, then leave most of the time for witnesses who have come from out of town who wish to be present, or who wish to testify. In 1965, I sponsored the original Consumer Fraud Law. That bill, as originally introduced, provided for statewide enforcement by the Attorney General. The bill that came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee listed a series of deceptive trade practices which are declared to be unlawful, provided as does, and the law has since provided, that the law enforcement official may go to court to get essentially an injunction or cease and desist order to prevent these practices from continuing. The bill passed the Senate in 1965 with statewide enforcement to the Attorney General's office. Went over to the House. That was still in there, and then it finally got deleted and confiscated. So in 1965, the law passed. And what the law did, this is the present Oregon law as someone amended, it listed a series of representations, often that can be made by sellers to buyers. And it said that if these representations are true, wonderful. On the other hand, if these representations are knowingly untrue, then this is a deceptive practice. And it listed a series of very specific representations. The bill also contained a provision against unwanted telephone solicitation. You recall a provision a person soliciting by telephone or added by door-to-door must disclose in the first 30 seconds name whom he represents and the true commercial purpose of his call. The bill also contained a provision about unwanted services in the home, particularly dismantling furnaces and other kinds of property around the home. The bill, as it came out of conference committee, was passed by the legislature in 1965, then only allowed for district attorney enforcement. Again in 1967, I came to legislature, and the legislature passed an improvement on this bill. The improvements were in three areas. First of all, the definitions were put more in accordance with the Uniform Act definitions that have been developed by the Council of State Governments. Secondly, we added the provision that it could be a deceptive trade practice if it was knowingly misleading in addition to being false. I remember an example being given to the committee at that time by District Attorney Donald Turner of Wasco County. An example he gave was fire alarm sales and came to Wasco County, went to his home and said, we'd like to put one on your wall temporarily because we're going to this community. We want to have one here. And Turner said, okay, and they put one on the wall. Then they went all through the town saying, this is such a good product that we should just install one in the home of the district attorney. This provision of knowing and misleading was added on the 67 session.
Mary, excuse me a minute. If you want to come in and you want to sit here in this chair, I'm sure some of your women will mind for a minute.
My pleasure. Again, in 1967, we sought statewide enforcement through the Attorney General. And again in 1967, this was not accomplished, though with a very substantial aid of the Oregon Chamber of Commerce executives working with the Oregon Consumer League and other groups who were able to provide the Attorney General with coordinate enforcement of the district attorney, but no budget was provided for this. In 1969, Representative Hansel and I put in the bill that I just referred to, which again provided for statewide enforcement, came out of committee but was defeated on the floor. The essential reason for statewide enforcement is that consumer fraud is very transient. Some of these fast buck operators may be not only in different states on succeeding days of the week, not only different counties, but in different states. And you have a situation, particularly in the home improvement area, where when the weather turns good in the spring, they may start out in the south and come on up, going to the counties of California and Oregon and on into Washington. It's very difficult for a district attorney to provide adequate enforcement for this bill for several reasons. First of all, he has a major responsibility, a primary responsibility in the area of criminal law enforcement. And when he has to choose, typically he will choose criminal law enforcement. Secondly, he typically does not have expertness in this area of consumer fraud, which is a growing specialty in the area of law enforcement. And third of all, he only may be faced with a particular scheme for a short period of time when it's going on to the next county or the next county. For these reasons, at the last legislative session, the Oregon Association of District Attorneys endorsed this predecessor bill providing for statewide enforcement. And I think I have not talked to them recently. I would hope that they would maintain that position. At the last session, I invited the Deputy Attorney General of the State of Washington to come down and testify before the committee considering this predecessor bill. And after pointing out that in many instances, consumer fraud that he had out of business in the state of Washington were still functioning in our state. He then made a plea to the Oregon Senate Committee saying, even if you don't pass this for your own sake, you in Oregon, please pass it for our sake in the state of Washington because it will help us with our law enforcement. We know where some of these operators are when they're in the state of California. Then there's a gap in our knowledge, then they're in our state. And he showed his injunctions that he had against operations that were still functioning in Portland and other parts of Oregon. Consumer fraud is very big business. Typically what the purveyor of a fraudulent consumer scheme does is he sells a method of selling. The product itself may differ from year to year. Maybe fire alarm is one year, maybe some other product another year. It's the technique that's essentially what it's selling. Now, let me make very clear that we're talking about a very small minority of business people, and we're talking typically, but not exclusively, about some of these transient sellers who are coming into the county and into the state. Not exclusively, but primarily. The vast, overwhelming majority of businessmen are honest and must be, because they're not trying for that single sale. They want a continuing relationship with the customer. For successful, legitimate businessmen, they have nothing to fear from better enforcement of the consumer fraud law. In fact, it will help them in unfair competition. In the state of Washington, approximately 50% of the complaints under their very effective consumer fraud law come from businesses and business trade associations who are concerned about unscrupulous practices of other people in their occupation. Also, in the state of Washington, they have caused a refund in 1 5-year period of $3 million to consumers, either by direct cash refunds or cancellation of contracts fraudulently obtained, $3 million over a 5-year period. Let me just briefly describe some of the major features of this bill and how we, where we derive them. There are essentially three sources of model consumer legislation at the present time. One is the Council of State Governments, and we leaned somewhat on them in the 1967 session, and some of their up-to-date conclusions are included in this bill. Secondly, the Federal Trade Commission has put out a model act, which incidentally has been adopted in a number of states, and we've leaned very heavily on that. And third, there is established about a year ago the National Consumer Law Center at Boston College Law School, and they have proposed a National Consumer Act, a model act for consumer protection, and we've included in a portion of this some of the definitions of consumer fraud contained in the National Consumer Act. The bill basically provides for better definitions of consumer fraud modeled on the National Model Act. It provides for statewide enforcement through the Attorney General. It provides for, in addition to local attorney enforcement, it provides for a variety of techniques to make the orders effective, including the potential of a receiver appointed for a business that's violating the act. It provides in a very interesting and important new provision that was not contained in the bill 2 years ago, for the possibility of private enforcement. So not only can a district attorney or the attorney general bring suit on a fraudulent practice, but a private person who is aggrieved, he himself may bring suit and may recover either actual damages or $200, depending a penny upon how he brings it. All right, then a very important provision is this act contains in Section 11 the potential of a class action, right, class suit, Section 11 sub 2 on page 7. One of the great problems in the area of consumer fraud is that the fraudulent sale may only be of a $10 or $15 or $20 item, not enough for that single individual to go to court to achieve redress. But there may be 100 different consumers who are affected in the same way. And if you can provide an effective way of providing a remedy for the smaller fraudulent transactions, and if you can group them through a class action technique, then you do provide an effective remedy in private hands. Now, as you know, I was back last week at the Consumer Federation of America meeting, and they were interested in establishing their thoughts on priorities for state and federal legislative action. They picked as one of their federal legislative priorities a similar class action bill pending before the federal Congress, being introduced by Senator Magnuson of Washington, which was considered last session. They consider one of their major priorities for state legislative action in 1971, enforceable, realistic state consumer fraud laws based upon the particular model that I brought to you. Madam Chairman, I've asked to come with me to testify, and he'll be available after any questions are put to me. David Shannon. Dave Shannon, I think, is at this point, the leading expert in the state of Oregon in enforcement of consumer fraud laws. He was the deputy district attorney in the county in charge of the enforcement of the consumer fraud laws of that county. And thereafter, he is currently enforcing consumer fraud laws in the tri-county area of Multnomah County and Washington County. He has spent full time in the enforcement of our present consumer fraud law. He's prepared, as soon as you're done with me, to go through this bill section by section to give you not only the background of how the words were chosen, but also to give you some instances from his very extensive experience. I'll be glad to respond to questions if I can.
I have a question.
Senator, it says comparative legislation.
Comparative legislation?
Yeah.
Well, in drafting the bill, we've drawn on legislation that is in effect in other states and has been recommended by national group concerned with this problem.
Yeah. Washington.
It was not covered with the Washington law. Washington law has a law which has a one-sentence definition of deceptive trade practice, which is the way, incidentally, I first introduced the bill before your committee, Senator Mahoney, in 1965.
This is a supplemental to or corollary to the present existing law with respect to the rights of the individual buyer, such as rescission.
We say in the bill that this is an addition to any other rights that buyers may have.
Number three. This bill meant for the approval of the Retail Credit Bureau of the Portland Chamber of Commerce.
I do not know. I still know.
You're a member of the Board of Directors, aren't you?
I remember the Board of Directors of the Portland Chamber of Commerce. This bill has not been submitted to the Portland Chamber. I assume the Retail Trade Bureau will be here to speak for themselves.
The reason I asked, they're sticking their nose in the whole room tax bill. I wonder. Number three, with respect to gambling statutes, for instance, by the DA is liable to loss of his office if he fails to investigate and prosecute gambling losses. Did you consider fixing that penalty clause here? If the DA refuses, or let's say neglects to enforce the law?
We did not consider that.
Don't you think that might be a violation?
I'd like to think about it, yes.
That's all.
Any other questions? John, I wonder if before you take your seat, if you might find a chair in the hallway for you.
Sure.
And a few others.
Well, Mary likes a chair.
I wonder if those are sitting out in the hallway. There's a Capitol guard out there. You might ask him if he's got some chairs around.
Maybe the clerk could call and see if he can get more chairs.
There's a Capitol guard right outside there.
Maybe get one.
I'm fine. Yeah, we got another one. Just for someone who's out in the hallway there, there's one now that's vacant. You could get another one over here.
Under this act or chapter in general, chapter 646, and
And we have brought or engaged in over 30 assurances of discontinuance, as it's called under the present statute. And under the proposed bill, it's called an assurance of voluntary compliance. It is our desire, and I'm sure that the further activity we have will be primarily in the assurance of voluntary compliance or discontinuance provision. To explain what that means or what that is, let me go through the process that we have when we get a complaint. A complaint will come into us either by telephone or by letter. And we, having the complaint, look at those facts that the customer talks about to see if the facts that he states are true would violate our statute as we understand it. If the facts he describes would violate our statute, then we would try to substantiate it, verify his facts to see if they're true, and to talk to the business frequently if there's a question here. Once we believe we've got a fair idea of what the facts are on this case, and it's not a blatant violation. A blatant violation might be a case, an example of that is a case where one individual sold one brand of antifreeze in the can of another, of a competitor. That was so obvious. One of the things, the regular antifreeze was blue and the substitute antifreeze was pink, so it wasn't too hard to catch. And we did some analysis, but that was a blatant and obvious switch and misidentification of product. There wasn't too much problem. But in case, unless there's a blatant violation, we would ask the business to come in and we'd talk to them. And we'd say, look, this is what we think you're doing. We think this is wrong and a violation of statute. We might get several responses. One, we didn't realize it was. It would be good to stop that now. Or frequently we get, well, we don't really like to do that, but we got to stay in competition. If you're going to stop us, look out for X, Y, Z, and down the line, which is an extremely important thing, that some businesses, I feel we have quite a bit of support from businesses, but partly just because if we're going to enforce it any at all, they want it to be enforced all the way across the board so that there's fair competition, so to speak, in this field. They might then agree to sign an assurance of voluntary compliance or discontinuance, which states that they don't admit that what they've done is wrong. But they henceforth agree to stop the following practices, or they not to do these things in the future. Excuse not stop, but not to do them in the future. And further, they might make positive. We will disclose these things. It's not only we won't stop doing this, but we'll disclose these things. And finally, it might be we'll take these measures to report to you to show how, in fact, we are compliant. And I think if we look at what the Federal Trade Commission does more and more, it's one thing to tell a fellow, okay, now you're going to stop this practice. It's another to be able to find out whether it's or not, and to get his cooperation and seeing that, in fact, the practice has been stopped. So that's an assurance of discontinuance. When that document is signed by himself and the district attorney's office and the court, would be enforceable by contempt of court. Now, we found out of the 30 that we've received that we have not had to bring one contempt proceeding. Doesn't mean that we won't have to, or it doesn't mean that we've been that effective. In a couple of companies we've had, they've stopped those things covered in assurance of discontinuance. But that hasn't stopped the kind of practices that we bothered. They just literally stayed to the law on those fields and let themselves open and rightfully have believed that we couldn't cover those other fields. So those are the kind of activities that we've presented and or tried to follow using the present statute. Now, we have several problems with the present statute. One of those is that the advertising statute is a 1911 Printers, Inc. statute, which has as its remedy a criminal action. Well, maybe it has been held constitutional in other states, but the statute says anything misleading or deceptive about the product and then provides for criminal penalty. I have never gone criminal on that statute, and I don't intend to go criminal. Each time I've used that statute, I've gone into the court and asked that they enjoin the practice on the grounds that the criminal statutes have as their background the common law nuisances, and that a crime may be a nuisance and therefore can be abated as a public nuisance. I don't think that we can use the criminal statutes in some of the same fields as we do the civil points to enjoin or even fines an intentional act. I would also point out that another statute that we rely on is the fake sale statute, which is again part of Chapter 646 and again has criminal penalties to it. That's the statute where a fellow advertises an article and doesn't make it available. Maybe he has one or two items and he uses it as a bait item to get the people in the store, and he's run out by the time the first customer has walked in the door. Well, again, I would prefer to go civilly on that statute, and when I use it, I have gone civilly. Third, we have the sales below cost statute, another part of Chapter 646, which again has criminal penalties. And that's the one that prohibits the sale of articles below cost, and then there's a presumption statute saying that if you limit when it's sold below cost, it's intended that you do so with a intent to injure competition, which is the illegal act in it. All right. Secondly, under the present statute or present case, our law that we now have, I have no investigative powers other than any ordinary attorney or the grand jury. The grand jury is, you know, used primarily for criminal acts, and would be extremely awkward. Excuse me.
That's fine. Are you departing from the usual DA policy in Multnomah County? Even though you don't take them. Suspect before the grand jury, write them a letter and suggest them come in.
So don't I
are in on the threat that you will take them before the grand jury?
No, I've never referred to the grand jury, and in only one action have I ever referred to the grand jury. I frequently ask people to come in, and I found as a primary response that they will voluntarily come in. But there are many companies out there that say, tough, you know, bring the action and then we'll see about it. And particularly when we get to the companies I'm describing, that you can see, we talk about them fly by night sometimes, but what I can see is reports by other state agencies that they're coming across the country almost like a wave. And you know them because you can identify the products that they're selling. And while the manufacturer says he's not participating in this kind of sales practice, he is strongly suggesting to his independent merchants that they use these kind of sales practices. So we can see them coming across the country. We know it's going to get here, or we can see a company move in, and we like to do something then. But this is the type of company that's going to say, where are your facts? You know, you can take it to the grand jury, but we're not volunteering anything to you. So under the statute that's being proposed, I mean, the bill that's being proposed here, if the district attorney or prosecuting attorney, including the AG, is suspect or has reason to believe that a deceptive practice is about to occur, he may take a deposition, in effect, or have a motion to produce or examine the records. And I think this is going to be a tremendous help to us. I would point out further that when I get to the that the person to whom the who is required to produce his records or to have a deposition taken up has 20 days to go to the courts and suggest good cause why he should not be made to do so. So there is a review function and protection in the courts. Third, I have no civil penalties now, and I think this could be tremendously helpful. After all, we have a case of one company that's moved into town that has assets, I would guess, over $160 million, and they're really making money using the practices they're using. So if I come along and say, stop it, I'm going to enjoin you. Well, what have I done? They just made a tremendous profit. They're stopped, and all I have to do now is start a new company, a new program. And yet it would be almost impossible to prove criminal on these kind of activities because the responsible party, unless you want to go against the corporation itself.
Have you ever used a long arm statute, or do you contemplate you could under the civil liability?
Well, there is a specific provision in this act about how we can get service, which is more flexible than now than it's present. Right now, I've never used it. No. I'm the first to admit that with this heavy caseload that I've had of day-to-day complaints, the complicated cases I've frankly shied away from. I do my best, but you can't answer 20 complaints a day and go around and write out a detailed complaint and handle a difficult question. You need trial help separately. So there are some out there that I have every intention of doing something about. I haven't had the ability or success so far to do something. Finally, this is another point. Under the extremely heavy caseload that we get in here, if people had the private actions, they wouldn't necessarily have to come to me on a lot of these things. And this would relieve me, just a pure personal point, it would relieve me of some of the extra duties that I, responsibilities that I'm glad to take on if I can, but that take away the opportunities to take the difficult cases or the cases that the private consumer danger. What do you do with an advertising, for instance, that's false, but nobody's bought under it, or you don't know if anybody's bought on it, or it's just run the first day? Under our private action here, unless the person's damaged, he wouldn't be able to bring the action. But there are many things that he could bring an action on, that he could more adequately take care of than I could. And people would probably be more willing to listen to him if they thought he did have that kind of possibility. Also, while we have enumerated in this bill the kind of specific acts that are prohibited, and there is no statute present which says where should we look to for guidance on what these specific practices are. There's always a question that says, this practice been under the bill or not? Frequently, I now go to the court and I say, Federal Trade Commission has handled this problem earlier, and this is the way they handled it. And sometimes the courts are willing to listen, and sometimes they're not. I think, and part of the reason is they say, well, what standing does it have? It doesn't have any standing at the present time. So I think that a section for interpretation, either by making current rules or by looking to some other agency, in particular federal agency, is tremendously important here. Now, if I might, I'd like to answer or go over any of the questions that you might have about specific provisions of the bill.
That'd be my hope.
All right.
Now, I don't know, Madam Chairman, how many people there are from out of town that want to testify.
We have three people besides Dave signed up. Do we have other people besides those who have indicated they want to testify? Who want to testify today?
If there are no more, sir.
Senator Robert, I don't wish to testify today, but I'd like to make a request to the committee.
We're not taking action on the bill
today.
We'll have another hearing.
And I think
we'll
probably
have a number of hearings.
Madam Chairman, I would suggest it might be useful, since there are no more than three other witnesses today, do take a little bit of time to go through the bill.
Senator Roberts, I'm learning more from the Department of Commerce. I've been handling the Governor's Task Force Consumer Protection for the last year. I would just like to speak highly in favor of this.
All right. You don't want to make any other statement except for support. I don't know if Turk got your name or not, but we'll check later. Okay, Dave, why don't you start and let's see what the bill is all about.
Section 2, which is the true beginning, is the definitions, and these definitions are not our individual definitions, but definitions taken out of the Uniform Act, except for the last two, which is the prosecuting attorney, and here the attorney general and the district attorney, it's a combined jurisdiction here, would be allowed to prosecute those appropriate violations. Section 5 relates to where the case may be heard, and the subdivision 5 subdivision B allows for cases to be brought in Marion County with the consent of the defendant, which would facilitate the Attorney General bringing his action.
Well, would that give the circuit court exclusive jurisdiction?
Yes.
Well, wouldn't the more appropriate place be some of the provision we made at the front of the district court? You wouldn't bring a suit for $16 and $200 damages in the circuit court, would you?
Well, that's a good point. I would, the intent of this bill was for injunctive action.
Those fellows down there in the circuit court are overworked. Some of them work 6 hours a week, you know.
You're saying for private action under this bill.
Is Senator Mahoney, are you referring to small claims only? Senator Mahoney,
pardon?
Are you referring to small claims only in district court?
Well, I think that should be amended by the circuit or district court.
Okay.
The section, would you like further discussion of the definitions? The other definitions go to what is subsection 6 bill to consumer goods. And that, in other words, this bill only covers consumer goods as opposed to sales or transactions between businesses. This is not intended to be covered here.
Or justice.
Examination goes back to that part I referred to earlier, the ability to look at documents and what documents can, in fact, be looked at upon the request of the prosecuting attorney. Section 3 of this bill is a combination of our present laws, but it's primarily modeled on the National Consumer Act.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, would you indicate which ones of these are in the present law so I'm brought up with you on information?
Well, first one is they're not in the same orders. A, B, and C of the present law are not in this one. Passing off goods, passing off goods or services of another, is similar to one we have on now, which would be section J, probably services that of another, as those of another, which is not identical language to the present statute, causing likelihood of confusion and misunderstanding of source, sponsorship, approval, or certification of goods or services is similar to H, but not...
Now you're talking about B, subsection B?
Yeah, subsection B. Subsection E of the present statute is similar to subsection C. Trained expert has other qualifications, sponsorships, that is affiliation, connection, association, or certification by another. Geographic origin is included in subsection H of the present statute in your representation about geographic origin. And that's subsection D of the present, of the proposed bill. These, again, were taken from the National Consumer Act. Subsection E is, again, a reflection of subsection E of present statutes, representing good services, sponsorship, approval for sellers trained. H, product is of a particular source, standard, quality, style, model, grade, geographic, original, or the particular characteristic, ingredient, use, benefit, or quantity. And this one says good, service, sponsorship, approval, characteristics, ingredients, use, benefit, quantity that they do not have, or that a person has sponsorship, approval, status, affiliation, and connection that he does not have. We use the we try to go to uniform language rather than to use the present statute because there's more case law under the uniform language than there is. Representing the goods are original or new if they are deteriorated, altered, reconditioned, reclaimed, used, or secondhand is an addition or an extension of subsection G of the present statute, which says seller's product, property, service is original or new. This goes on beyond it. It says representing the goods are new if they are deteriorated, altered, reconditioned, reclaimed, used, or secondhand, which goes on to explain what is not a new product, rather than to say it's new and it's not. Because what do you do about, one of the points here was deteriorated. What do you do about a product that's in your inventory for 2 or 3 years, never been sold? Now, is that a new product or isn't it? And this one gives you clear definition as to what that is. What do you do about a demo in a sale of a car? Is that new or isn't it? So this was trying to be more specific as to what was meant by new. G, representing that goods or service are of a particular standard, quality, grade, or that goods are of a particular style and model if they are of another. Again, this goes back as an extension out of subsection H and E of our present statute. And really, these are unfair competition in the primary, unfair competition histories to them, where one company tries to pass off their product as that of another. I'm thinking particularly of the Sears case where they tried to pass off their lamps as the same as Stifel's, and they're in the same design quality and all kinds of representations. And this is where our primary case law comes from this one.
Excuse me, may I interrupt just a moment before I could get my question here? Don, you spoke of in former proposed legislation, the word knowingly, willfully or intentionally was in there, and is there anything in Section 3 that specifies that any of these things you're declaring unlawful have to be willfully, intentionally, or knowingly decayed?
There's a difference in remedy. If this is a willful violation, you've got the potential of a $2,000 civil penalty. If it's not necessarily, then you've got the question between two parties, one who represents the facts are not as representative, who should suffer the loss or be halted on this thing. I think this is the kind of question that was brought. I think as a practical matter, you will find most cases, if it was an accidental or unknowing kind of situation, it wouldn't fall under these.
But it isn't specified anywhere that this is true. Now, this is what I'm worried about, this kind of legislation. Because I may be a retailer of goods, and I buy my goods from a wholesaler, and some of these things may be in the product that I'm selling, and not knowingly or willfully or anything else. I'd be guilty of these things without any intention of being guilty.
Yeah. What would happen was if we brought it against you would ask to stop doing that. And then if you violated that, stopping doing that, then you could be penalized. If it was an act that wasn't with, and we had to prove the fact that you intentionally didn't deceive the customer,
I see.
Then we could bring a present action. Otherwise, it's a second chance statute.
I see. Yeah. Now, there may be a court interpretation of this, I don't know, but you take on page 3, line 9, 10, 11, and 12. I think any good lawyer could drive a coach and pour through that language. Causing likelihood of confusion. Causing likelihood of confusion. Got anything to say about that?
Quiet.
What do you mean by that? Some people, and I myself, I'm so stupid with respect to many items offered for sale on us that I can't even hardly buy my own socks. Now, what do you got to say about that? I think that's kind of loose language.
I hear two points of this in primary.
Causing likelihood of confusion.
Well, we have a benefit of past case history, and we also have an interpretation section here which says that we'll point to the interpretations brought under section of the Federal Trade Commission section.
Okay. If you have.
Yeah.
If you have.
Yes. Yeah. And I would suggest, and also the Attorney General would be able to, under these provisions, make rules and regulations to clarify points.
But Dave, Senator Mahoney hits on a point, like the reason to know sort of thing that's in the statutes and in the criminal statutes. If you put this kind of language in there, likelihood of confusion, then you're basing your case upon the ability of the consumer to either be confused or not confused, rather than whether or not he was. Language, because if you've got a stupid consumer, he's more likely to be confused than a smart consumer. But you can't treat the consumers differently because of their innate ability to be confused or not confused.
What we're really talking about in these kind of sections are cases of advertising, other representations where we don't necessarily have a consumer who's brought a complaint or one that's knowledgeable under the FTC. you don't have to bring in as actual victims. We're talking about stopping or enjoining or defining what kind of practices. If an ad runs for 5 or 6 days or maybe 2 weeks, we may not get the feedback on it until much later. At the same time, as a matter of fact, what we did one time in the past was we brought under Chapter 27 a suit without an action without suit without a cause of action. Is that where you? It's an informal kind of advisory opinion by the court as to whether the matter is deceptive or not. If you've got strong case law from the Federal Trade Commission, from other states interpreting this, and you don't, and the ad is currently going on now, it's been brought to your attention, you want to be able to go to the business and say, this is what's going on.
But the Federal Trade Commission, of course, while their orders are subject to appeal, nevertheless, it's not they're not immutable. They have a peculiar power. For instance, right now they're fighting the Standard Oil are fighting them. But the courts wouldn't be allowed the same power or the same latitude in interpreting as the Federal Trade Commission has arrogated into itself. Is that not true? In other words, can you safely say that a ruling of the Federal Trade Commission is binding on the courts?
No, I don't think it is binding on the courts, but the Federal Trade Commission can't go beyond its legislative authority. I point out, however, though, that we've had statutes like the Federal Trade Commission and like the Washington, which says any unfair or deceptive trade practice is hereby declared unlawful on the books for quite a while, and we do have a substantial number of case law under this. And I think we're narrowing our field, but the problem is...
You say it's persuasive.
Yeah. I think the problem is that if you try to be too specific, then some ingenious fellow is going to come up with a theory that you're not going to cover, and that's what happens time and time again.
Now, let me clarify then. What you're saying here in these provisions is that you can bring an action where you really don't have a consumer yet who has an aggrieved consumer.
Right.
You can take action here, and so then the likelihood of confusion is a standard that the courts could use, the reasonable man standard or anything they
want
to determine, because they don't have the actual consumer.
And the court would make a determination whether, yes, would set a standard as to what was a
likelihood of confusion.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're taking an awful lot of time, and I'm doing it too, as well as other members of the committee, but it appears, Dave, that you're going to be back with us quite frequently.
Madam Chairman, the Speaker sent a note that a while ago he wanted to see me. May I be excused?
You may be excused. Senator McPherson, go ahead.
I had a question here. What's the history on this particular wording? I think you referred to this. Is this something that has been used elsewhere, that has been tried in courts, and is this, or is this brand new wording that we should be looking at very critically from the standpoint of the entire subsection 3?
No. These statements come primarily out of common law cases of unfair competition. Most of this isn't consumer legislation. legislation to begin with. It's only been adopted. And where you cause likelihood of confusion, you've got cases going back to 1890 on one person passing off their product to somebody else so they can raise their price even though they make a cheaper product. But we've got a tremendous amount of on the confusion between whose article it is. That's not the same as deceiving the customer about the quality of the article. There are lots of case law on this kind of competition questions.
I might supplement his answer. This language, I believe, is the same word as the 1967 FTC Model Act, which has been adopted in 10 states.
Well, that's basically right. This is a Model Act, and it's been in law. Certainly a lot of these problems are being brought up.
It's changed. I mean, the Model Act has been changed by the FTC in 67, 69, and 70, but we'll be glad to get to the derivation of any particular language that you're questioning about.
Well, not having as much of a background as you people have, but I have to accept a lot of this pretty much on face value, and I think if it's been used, say, in 10 states, I think it can't be all bad, but nevertheless, we should take a look at it.
Sure.
Okay, I wonder if we can go a little bit more rapidly, and we'll try to discipline ourselves a little bit and not pick at these particular words this time around, so that we get the whole picture of the bill and get these other
Section H provides that if you disparage somebody else's product falsely, this would be a violation. To advertise goods, and bait and switch on Section I is an important point, that you don't intend to sell them as advertised. Let's say you advertise a product at a very low price, and when somebody comes in, you do everything possible not to let them buy it. And then if they still insist, you don't have it in stock. This is a typical bait and switch type of program that this would cover. One of the more interesting sections, I think, is Section R, which is different, making any false, misleading, or deceptive statement about a prize, contest, promotion to publicize a product, business, or service. We've been deluged in Portland with free vacations, which don't relate to the product at all, but are a basis for getting into your home, and the free vacation isn't a free vacation at all. But those misrepresentations don't talk about the product. They are simply a means and method of getting in, and once they've got you in the right position, then we get things that people regret by having purchased other things. Section 4 of this act, states that conduct in compliance with other states, other agencies, or federal, state, local government agencies cannot be prosecuted under this, or this can be raised as a defense. 2 says that the media is not to be held responsible unless they have a financial interest or they have actual knowledge of the false or deceptive information. Section 5 of this act is the interpretation, which says that the intent of legislature to take due respect for the Federal Trade Commission Act, 15 U.S.C. 45. This is the rules and regulations set by the Federal Trade Commission under their Section 5A. And also says the Attorney General Section 2 allows the Attorney General to put in provisions. Section 6 allows the state or the prosecuting attorney to bring injunctive actions. It says before it brings the injunctive actions in Section 2 that it'll notify the company that's bringing the action and give them 7 days to get notice so that they can then come to the district attorney or prosecuting attorney, say, look, you guys are all wet or something, or this is, you got your facts wrong, and or we'll be willing to do this and that. But it doesn't bind the prosecuting attorney to accept an assurance of voluntary compliance. It just says that they'll be given prior notice so they won't be surprised. But if it's an emergency section, Section 3 allows you to go ahead. If you've got a basis, if a fly-by-night outfit, it's going to be here 1 week and it's going to be gone. And we've had many periodical companies do that. They bring a crew in and they're gone. And you've got to move fast. Section 7 allows for assurance of voluntary compliance. Section 8, that's the one that assurance of discontinuance that I described earlier. Section 8 states that if the state prevails, it may get its preparation, expenses of preparation and prosecution. That's not attorney's fees, that's just expenses of preparation and prosecution. Section 9 allows the court to make gives the court additional powers, or clarifies the fact the court has additional powers to alleviate the losses by private citizens in actions in which the state has taken action. Section 10 allows for receivership. And time and time again, we find that the companies we're dealing with are just on the borderline of going broke. Maybe this is why they're doing it. I can't figure out the philosophy of why they're doing it, but to be able to set up a receivership and they get money frozen so that we can get what money we can back to the consumer in those kind of cases, or to the creditors, I think this is important. Section 11 allows for private action for $200 or damages, whichever is greater. Subsection 2 of Section 11 allows for class actions. 3 says that any action like this brought by a private group or the district attorney, the papers or notice should be sent to the attorney general so he can know what's going on in the city. And I think that's an important section because lots of times private actions will be brought and we'll never hear about it. And maybe we ought to hear about it because there may be action we should take. Section 5 is an important act section, and it says that if an injunction, this isn't an assurance of discontinuance, but if an injunction is successfully terminated by the decree that gained by the prosecuting attorney, that may be used as prima facie evidence in a private action brought by somebody under the same set of facts, so that the burden's not quite so high on that. Section 12 of this act is the investigative rights that I talked about, which again allows the person in 20 days to answer in 20 days under subsection 2 and have it moved to the court to quash the demand. Section 13 is serving a process, and it's slightly more liberal than our present statutes. Allow personal service outside the state, and mail the last known address if we're having a hard time actually getting service on the individual. Section 14 says that if the company, without good cause, not having gone to the court to say we don't want to testify or we don't want to produce our evidence, just ignores the complaint, then the prosecuting attorney may go into the court and ask that the activity be enjoined until such time that they do answer. Now, this is very important because when you get a fly-by-night company again, it's coming across the state, and you want certain information, and they're going to get as much as they can just to delay you. If you don't have, if they refuse to give you the information, you can stop them participating in the state until they do give you that information. And if they're a legitimate business, there shouldn't be trouble with giving you that kind of information. This section was used in the state of Iowa quite successfully against one of our chain letter type of programs that were went across the country last year. Section 15 is our old Section 3 of our Chapter 646, which says that there shall be disclosure within 30 seconds on the phone or door-to-door as to if you're a seller and as to who you are, and is dismantling or performing services in the residence without authority. That does not cover the guy who does work without authority in his shop. And we get lots of those calls, but this doesn't cover it. Section 3 relates to referral selling, which is one of our greatest headaches. And this is the question of the guy who tells you that you can get the machine for no money out of your pocket. He doesn't say free anymore. If you'll give us 40 names, and we'll give you $10 for each name of the person we're able to make a demonstration to. And Section 16 are the penalty section, and these are second chance penalties, $25,000 if you violate the willful violation of the injunction or the assurance. It's not a, and then $2,000 if it's a willful violation or the person should know at the time that he committed the act, the first act, that he was violating the statute. Section 17 allows for the dissolution of a franchise or a company that violates these injunctions. That's a remedy very sparingly used elsewhere, but in some cases it's inappropriate. Section 18 says the district attorney has to report to the attorney general his activities, which is a continuation of the coordination function, which I think is important. And Section 20 is our penalty section.
Okay, now questions from the committee.
Madam Chairman, we will have time later to go through this and ask specific questions about these sections.
You will. Okay, thanks, David. Solomon Johnson. Mr. Johnson, would you state your name?
Solomon Johnson, 137 North East Beach Street, Portland. 1968, went to a automobile dealer, inspected 1961 Lincoln Continental. I was told that the car had all new brakes, carburetor, air conditioning, and a complete motor overhaul. I was told by the salesman that the car would be sold to me for $1,200. He said the car had been repossessed at a low price. And I gave him $500 down. Excuse me, I gave him $300 down with the promise of $200 that evening. When I returned to the dealer, I was told that they couldn't let the car go for $1,200 because of the air condition and the way that it's been done to the car. And they wanted $1,600. I asked for my money back, and I was told that the money was in the floor safe. It was after 5 o'clock, and couldn't be opened for the next day. I returned the following day, pick up the car, go to the finance company, sign the contract. The car completely failed to work on the way to the finance company. I asked for my money back again. The sales manager assured me that the car would be fixed to my satisfaction, and he signed it on the contract. After I had the car for 3 days, the transmission began to race at low speed, windshield wipers did not work, the door would not lock or close, the brakes had a loud squeak, fumes came in through the air condition, the water came in through the heat ventilators, a loud tapping noise in the engine. I returned the car to the dealer. I was told that the car was... because the car was a big car, that it had heavy-duty new brake shoes on it, and this is why the car, the brakes squeaked. He also stated that if the car had, was driven for a year or so, that this tapping would disappear, and that the noise was probably a loose lip there, and it was too expensive to overhaul the motor. And if it became a problem, that they would fix it. I had the car checked by an independent mechanic. And they indicated to me that the car was nearly worthless. I returned the car to the dealer on several occasions, but each time I returned the car, they informed me that it would make the work that's necessary or the repair that's necessary and convince me to keep the car. I finally was a victim of an automobile accident on a freeway because of expected brakes in this particular automobile. I visited 3 private attorneys who refused to take my case against the dealer. I kept trying to work out an arrangement with the dealer. I finally promised to give him, he finally promised to give me a new car within 10 days and that I should keep the car. Days went by and I went to the dealer. They had my car and they told me to keep it another 10 days. And one day I was passing by and saw two Continentals on the lot. I stopped in and he said that it was costing me an additional $500 for another car because the cars that they had on the lot had new engines in. The next evening I picked up the car after 2 or 3 days and transmission began to bang. The windshield wipers didn't work. So, I was finally in another accident when the brakes failed again at a stoplight. The car was severely damaged and it had not been driven since. The legal aid service handled this matter for me and we were fortunate enough to reach a beneficial settlement.
Mr. Johnson,
yes.
Mr. Williams indicated that he wanted to make a comment. Do you wish to join me up here?
intended to do today is bring down some stories of some people that have been victimized by deceptive trade practices. And so that under the new law, this would not be as likely to happen in any case. Mr. Johnson is one example of a person that's had flagrant misrepresentations made to him. And there's practically nothing right now that he can do to protect himself against the dealer in a situation like this. And there's nothing that's being done by, or little that's being done by the state and the DA to induce dealers not to do this, to provide them with some sort of deterrent to making this type of misrepresentation and sales practice. I have statements here from three more people. Are you through with your statement? Do you have any questions?
I think the cleaner has any questions.
I have three statements which, for the sake of saving time, I can just submit to the committee in writing, and I have two more witnesses who can testify.
Sandra Mortimer, who I have here, is one witness.
Okay. And Mr. Fulberg would also
testify. Jay Fulberg.
At 602 Southeast 38th Street. And one day, the man came up to our door and said, "Would you like to win a prize?" Yeah, and he said, "If you have the lucky number, you get the prize." So a few days later, a woman called and asked for the card and told me that I had the lucky number. And I want a Corningware dishware. And when the prize was delivered, the salesman came to demonstrate a vacuum cleaner. He informed me that the vacuum cleaner was more than simply a vacuum cleaner, that it would act as an air purification system for the entire house, taking all the dust out of the air. It would also perform many amazing feats. The cost of this vacuum cleaner, $440. We purchased it on a referral sale program by which we would get $5 for everyone that we could find to buy a vacuum cleaner, if they bought it or not. We would get the $5 on our sales arc for the vacuum cleaner. It soon became apparent that the vacuum cleaner involved was nowhere near what it had been, what it should be. It did not purify the air or did not do anything else. It did not even vacuum the rug. We are involved in a court battle in this matter for nearly a year now, in which we have been defending an action brought by the sailor. This case is still pending.
I'd like to point out that if there were a $200 minimum damage provision and so forth, definitely be a deterrent to making the representations in cases such as this one. And Mr. Fulbert can address himself to that briefly later.
Other questions
from
the committee members?
Well, I would like to have, get back to Mr. Johnson. Would you point out the specific cause here that would have covered his particular action here when he bought his car? Which one would you have prosecuted under?
Well, misrepresenting representing the goods were original and new. They told Mr. Johnson that his engine was rebuilt when it wasn't. They told him that it was in good condition. There were several things that are, that are actually covered under the existing law, and some things that are a little hazy under the existing law, which would be, I think, brought into focus by some of the broader language here.
And that's what I was getting back is, well, why couldn't you have done it under the present law? Because it looked to me like the same things that were covered in the law that's now on the books.
It's true, but the, you know, the criminal or the enforcement of the state,
the enforcement
of type of law is just, you know, not existent right now. As Mr. Shannon has said, the only person in four counties is enforcing this law, and automobile dealers such as Mr. Johnson Dublin can make these representations unless it's imputed.
Did anyone go to the district attorney and ask him? He was the one that was charged with enforcing it.
I'm sure we wrote or sent something over to David.
Now, Mr. Fuller.
Before I make a statement, if I could, I'd like to answer Senator McPherson's question a little further about...
Your full name and whether or not you're representing someone or your address or something like that.
Certainly. My name is Jay Fulberg, and I'm a supervising attorney at the Albina Legal Aid Office. I'm not here to represent any one person. F-O-L-B-E-R-G. Senator McPherson, I did represent Solomon Johnson after he came into legal aid. Previous to seeing us, Solomon Johnson had visited with two private attorneys, neither one of whom was willing to take his case. Upon hearing of Solomon Johnson's story involving the car that he told you of, we sent him to still a third attorney. That attorney refused to take his case, and I talked to that attorney. I can represent that the attorney indicated to me that he felt that there would be a good chance to rescind the contract that Solomon Johnson had. He saw no opportunity for any punitive damages or any other recovery other than to get Solomon Johnson's money back. There was no provision at that time for attorney fees in the case. At the time Mr. Johnson went to see this attorney, he had had some economic hardships. He was unemployed, and the attorney did not want to put himself in position of recovering his fees from the money that Solomon Johnson, he felt, rightfully had coming back to him. And thus he refused to take the case, because there would be no attorney fees for him unless it came out of the very meager assets at that time, Mr. Johnson. The provision of this bill, which would allow for attorney fees, would certainly cover that point, and I think that's a good example of a case that legal aid could have had a private attorney handle had this bill then been enacted in effect. Further, there were problems with proof as to the personal injuries, but that really wasn't a significant consideration of the attorney. Also, as to whether or not the matter had been referred to Mr. Shannon, as we understood the existing law, all that Mr. Shannon could do was stop this practice in the future. It wouldn't help Mr. Johnson at all. And Mr. Johnson was concerned about others being taken by the same dealer. But his principal concern was getting back those much-needed assets because he couldn't afford another car until this matter had been taken care of. So the existing law just wasn't adequate. It all covered the problem. And this law, if passed, if this became law, it would cover that problem. It was not intended. A significant amount of the work done by legal aid service on behalf of poor people is done in the area of consumer problems. We've dealt with roughly 1,000 consumer complaints ourselves over the last year. In addition, Legal Aid Service acts as a lawyer referral service for the Multnomah County Bar. We refer people to private attorneys if they're over the economic income guidelines established by the federal government for our services, or if the case that they have might generate a fee for private attorneys. I talked to a lot of attorneys on the phone in attempting to refer these cases, as do others in our offices. And the attorneys are generally quite interested in these consumer problems, but generally they won't take the case, primarily because there's just no fee in it. And they're usually dealing with people who have had economic hardship because of the action of a seller. And the attorney often doesn't want to put himself in the position of charging the fee of a relatively poor person, particularly when the result is very uncertain in the present law. In addition, the attorneys on the other side of these cases, who represent the sellers and collection companies, are very expert in the area in which they deal. They deal repetitively in that area, and the attorneys to whom we refer these cases are aware of that. So when that's combined with the likelihood of no fee and an improbable result in the case, it's very difficult for us to refer any of the consumer cases out that we get in. Most of the actions and the cases in the consumer area that come into legal aid service are in the context of a person who's being sued by a seller of merchandise or the collection company to which the seller has assigned the note or assigned the papers. As the current law exists, we're not in a very good position to raise a counterclaim in those cases. And the most that we can usually do, even though the goods and services are often not as promised, is negotiate in behalf of the purchaser, our client, the consumer, and
we rarely are able to obtain full satisfaction. The consumer usually ends up paying something, even though the goods and merchandise were not as promised. In those rare actions, when a consumer comes in before he's being sued and says they'd like to do something because they feel they've been taken by a consumer, the amounts involved are usually very small, $10, $15, $20, that he's actually been damaged. Even though legal aid service doesn't charge a fee, we still have to look at the economics of the court system and the economics of the utilization of our time, because there are more demands made upon it than we can satisfy. And it's just not practical for a private attorney, nor a legal aid attorney, to handle a case for $10, $15, or $20. We do it on occasion. But the class action provision of the bill would certainly help make the use of not only the lawyer's time, but the use of the court facility much more economic and much better use of taxpayers' resources. The problem that we see in telling clients who come into it, particularly those clients who are just marginally over our income guidelines, so we can't help them. But I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. No private attorney will handle your case. It's too small. Legal aid service can't take it because you're over our income guidelines. Or even if you're under the income guidelines, we still might not be able to take it. The most we can do is try to clear you if they sue you. There's a very high level of frustration and malcontent that I'm sure we've all felt ourselves. In knowing that a matter doesn't merit a great deal of our time, and yet you know that someone has taken unfair advantage of you, and there's virtually no legal remedy. And that exists quite frequently. Therefore, in summary, I think that the provisions I would most like to address myself to are those that provide a $200 minimum damages, which would make the cases more attractive to the clients to sue. For instance, in Mr. Johnson's case, he did get his money back at the cost, but I can assure you that he had to spend hours and hours in my office in the courts waiting, and he received no compensation for his time. And it's so rarely that a person is able to go against a dealer in that regard that it's not really much of a hardship for a dealer, and that would help. In addition, the provision for attorney's fees would allow legal aid service to refer a great number of cases that we're now unable to find any lawyer to handle, and legal aid service very often can't handle those cases either. And finally, the class action aspect of this bill would make it much more practical for legal aid service to try to do something significant where a large number of people come in. For instance, in one vacuum cleaning company, have had more than 20 people come in to see us or have been referred to us, who have all been taken by the same scheme. And we just don't have the resources generally to bring 20 cases when the relative amounts are small. I'd like just to end with one example. I represented a fellow who had very severe economic hardships occur. He became unemployed because of an injury. He wasn't able to get employment. He had problems. He was kicked out of the apartment he lived in because he couldn't pay the rent. We had to negotiate with utility companies because he couldn't pay his bills. We finally thought we got things more or less resolved, and he had joined the program which was trying to train him for a new job. And he called me, and he wanted me to know that he thought his economic problems were over with, because he just bought a vacuum cleaner. And one of the benefits of buying this vacuum cleaner was that he would get $10 for each person who referred to this vacuum cleaner company. And with all of his friends, he knew that this would soon get him out of the hole economically. And of course, we knew from our past experience that it's mathematically impossible, or virtually impossible, for him to come anywhere close to paying for the vacuum cleaner referral at $10 each, which was over a $400 machine. He had a loan to help himself out of the hole. And the person that sold him the machine was very much aware of his economic situation. And that was the big sales pitch. I know you're poor. I know you don't have any money, but I'm going to help you out. And I think this bill would certainly cover the referral sales fees that Mr. Shannon and legal aid see so much of in their hardship.
Questions, Mr.
Demo form holds.
Would you state your name and who you're representing?
Reggie Floyd. Representing Demo form. and consumers.
And you're submitting the same problem?
Yes, and I'd like to.
All right, fine. Mr. Moore, did we get you identified properly?
Ernie Moore from the Department of Commerce, and I've been working with our tenant in the consumer complaint problem with the government consumer affairs task force. And I just wanted to go on record that we favor this very highly.
Is this the Department of Commerce that favors this, or is this the executive?
The Office of Consumer Protection.
The Office of Consumer Protection. This concludes the hearing today on Senate Bill 50. We are adjourned.
Consider for introduction.
action relating to requiring the grantor of real property to indicate in any of the instruments granting real estate or interest in real estate, to indicate on the instrument whether or not road access is available to the property, and if not, an indication that there is no road access to the property. This is a problem that is raised quite often to county governments. A person will purchase a piece of property and not be aware of the physical layout, and after obtaining the property, find that they have no access to the property, and then of course come to the county and seek some type of road into their property. And we would ask that to this committee for their consideration in introducing this as a bill of the Consumer Affairs Committee.
Any questions?
This will be answered by the
administration. Right.
Right.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. I wondered if your bill goes far enough. I think it's far a bigger problem than just no access and improper access. I think we've run into problems much down in our county with roads that are not really roads. They're appear to be roads, but they're not legal roads, and the county therefore cannot take them over. Is there any effort in this bill to also notify the people that perhaps the road that appears to be a road is not a legal road, and therefore will never be maintained by the...
Yes, we haven't gone this far, and there is this distinction between a public road and what is actually a adopted county road, which the county has the requirement to maintain and upkeep. However, the statutes provide that they cannot expend revenues on public roads that aren't a part of the system. We felt that this would be an initial step when this gets to committee, if it is the committee's desire. I think this would be most appropriate to identify whether this is a public road or whether it is a county road or a state road or a city street that services a particular property. And of course there are varying indications then as to the degree of maintenance that will be provided on that road.